Good morning, friend. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show. Bumper music issue, so I'm coming in naked. Well, at least I'm not dreaming that I'm naked at school, which is always a fun one, one I haven't had in a while. But anyway, I digress. I'm back with you. Already got a coffee stain on my pant leg. Day's starting off good. Oh, well, there was a little flavor of bumper music. There we go. Isn't that more pleasant to hear music in the background? Instead of my nasally voice alone. Anyway, good to be with you today. We're going to have a good show. It is a Friday, and a Friday for a long weekend, so that's even better. And lots to talk about today as we do all things, looking at things through the Catholic faith, through the lens of the Catholic faith. The beautiful thing about Catholicism, the very word means universal. And so it really is not simply a belief system as if we've got a little cordoned off piece of the pie that is our faith life. Really, the Catholic faith is not just one slice. It's the whole pan the pie rests in. It is meant to guide and direct. That's all in our lives. That's why the means universal. It's the whole truth for the whole person and for the whole world. So I'm thrilled to be Catholic personally. So glad to be with you today. Second hour, we're going to talk to my good friend Chelsea Zimmerman, who's a monthly guest. Chelsea, who is the editor-in-chief at Catholic Lane, but also has her own blog, reflectionsofaparalytic.com. Chelsea, who suffered a spinal cord accident, injury while she was in high school, and is paralyzed from the chest down, and has a particular interest in things related to bioethics, because as you've seen, this issue of bioethics, particularly oftentimes it's people with spinal cord injuries that folks appeal to, and they're concerned for them when they want to justify things like embryonic stem cell research. Chelsea goes against the current in that regard as a devout Catholic and as one who believes in the dignity of the human person from conception to natural death. And so she's an important witness and voice to say, the ends do not justify the means. And so we're going to talk to her a little bit about a couple things. One, about Katie Couric's remark, which I've talked a little bit about before, that she made on the Stephen Colbert show, being interviewed and talking about Pope Francis in a recent conference that she attended at the Vatican. And she was very impressed with how progressive the church is and now about science. And, it's Katie Couric. I'm not expecting her to be a historian, okay? So I'll cut her some slack. But again, that's one of the common myths or misconceptions about the Catholic Church, that the church has somehow been hostile to science, when it's really quite the opposite. The church has really facilitated scientific inquiry. So we'll talk about Katie Couric a little bit with Chelsea. And also, we're going to talk about a film that's coming out, not this weekend, but next weekend. It's called Me Over You. It's a romantic film that deals with a man who himself is paralyzed by an injury. Unfortunately, there's an undertone to the film, or one that manifests itself late in the film, according to the book it was based on the idea of euthanasia or assisted dying, whatever you want to call it. Physician-assisted suicide, that the gentleman in the wheelchair, who is sort of the central character of the film, I guess, decides that life is no longer worth living, and the person who loves him helps him achieve his goal of death. And there are disability groups around the world who are protesting this film, saying that it is the equivalent of a disability snuff film. We'll talk with Chelsea a little bit about it and the way disabilities are oftentimes portrayed in Hollywood. So all that coming up in the second hour. Also want to talk about a common graduation quote that I want to rethink just a little bit. The mess going on at Baylor University, and also the Marian Bridge with Islam that is oftentimes not considered. Archbishop Fulton Sheen talked a lot about it. But perhaps a connect point as we seek to find a way to live with each other in the world, people of different faiths. So all that and more. We certainly welcome your calls, and I'll have the question of the day in the next segment. 573-4-BREAD-4 is the number you can call or text anytime during the program today. 573-4-BREAD-4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow at gmail.com. You can also post your thoughts on Facebook or on Twitter. And as I said, we'll give you the question of the day in the next segment. It's graduation season. I attended another graduation last night. My daughter's best friend, Anna, who's like another daughter to us, and Naomi similarly with the other girl's family. I haven't quite figured out a way to claim Anna on my taxes, but I'm hoping I can come up with a way to do that sometime soon. Of course, they could probably, Anna's family could do the same thing. And I had the privilege of going to her graduation last night from the Lexington Latin School, which is a school, I think, that meets 3 or 4 days a week. It is all the, you know, from K all the way through 12. It's classical education, a great school. Anna's really enjoyed her time there. What I liked particularly about the graduation was that there were 6 in the graduating class. As someone who has sat through many a graduation where there were hundreds in the graduating class, it was really, really nice, let me tell you. Because to me, the worst part of graduation is when you have to sit through that Andrew Abner, Mary Beth Absher, Susie Anderson, you're sitting there, and you look down, and man, oh, they're only through the D's? Are you serious? So going last night was nice. 1 of 6. It was a really nice ceremony. So congratulations to Anna. Congratulations to all graduates that are out there. But, you know, here's the thing that I guess you wouldn't want to create a drinking game for graduation. That wouldn't be a good witness or example or role model for the kids. But if you did, you probably could throw one back throw several back every time you hear the quote from Francis Bacon, knowledge is power. I mean, is there ever a graduation that goes by that either in the salutatorian address or the valedictorian address that you don't hear some attribution of Francis Bacon's knowledge is power? And it has a certain resonance. I mean, it's graduation. These kids have learned a lot. They've reached this culminating point. It's also a commencement. It's a beginning of a new stage in their life. They're going to go forth armed with this knowledge that is going to help them, in the words of TV radio guru Dr. Laura Schlesinger, take on the day. They're going to take on the world with this knowledge that they have, because knowledge is power. But it occurred to me, another perspective as a Catholic, is that knowledge is not power, always power. Yes, it's power in the sense that you can harness knowledge to some greater end. But knowledge is also vulnerability. And here's what I mean. And this is a deeply ingrained reality in Catholic thinking. In Catholic thinking, knowledge brings accountability. You are responsible for what you know. We undergird our whole idea of sin and culpability with this understanding, right? That's why, what is it that it takes for a sin to rise to the level of what we call a mortal sin, a sin that destroys the divine life of grace in the soul? That is, you know, the word mortal means fatal. It's fatal to our salvation. What is it that makes a sin mortal? Well, one of the things is we have to do it not only with full consent, but we have to do it with full knowledge. Full knowledge of the gravity of our actions, full knowledge of the wrongness of what we do. Because knowledge brings responsibility. This same concept is woven into our court system as well. This is why we have degrees of guilt and so forth. Knowledge brings a particular culpability, and we become responsible for what we know. So, we think about that in terms of, for example, what that means related to our responsibility for the faith. There was an interesting story I saw on my friend Brantley's website yesterday called churchpop.com, making holy all the things. It's a great website. It's kind of a Christian BuzzFeed. He talked about the incident way back in, let's see, what year was it? There was 1981. There was an Australian who hijacked a plane from Dublin to London. And what was his demand as a hijacker? Was that Pope John Paul II release the third secret of Fatima? You know, the apparitions of the Blessed Virgin Mary to the three Portuguese children way back in the 19-teens. There was a third secret of Fatima that had been given to the local bishop, passed on to Rome, that had never been revealed. And this Australian, Lawrence James Downey, demanded that the third secret of Fatima, that was his hijacking demand. It's got to be a one of a kind, right? But here's the thing, that the ironic thing that struck me is, here's a guy who's a Catholic who somehow thinks that, I guess, the third secret of Fatima is going to be some key in Catholics being faithful in the world, and he's hijacking a plane. So check me if I'm wrong, Sandy, or Lawrence James Downey. You don't need the third secret of Fatima to know that hijacking a plane is wrong. So we're going to get into this in the second hour because, you know, it has implications for us in terms of our own spirituality. We already know a lot more than we do. That should be what occupies us, not obscure third secrets, in my opinion. So, knowledge, power, yes. Knowledge, responsibility. We'll be back. This is the Mike Allen Show. Minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show on this Friday. That's right, it is a Friday of a long holiday weekend, so don't forget that it's not just about grilling out on Monday. It's giving thanks for those who've paid the ultimate price to defend this country and the freedoms on which she stands. So thank you for all those who are veterans. And for those who are currently serving in the armed forces, we thank you for your sacrifice and your service. My question of the day, I've been seeing this thing on ESPN's website, highlights over the years of the National Scripps Spelling Bee, which I was fascinated with the Spelling Bee. I always wanted to do well. Unfortunately, I still have scarring memories of the fifth grade classroom Spelling Bee. Right, you got to win your classroom or be first or second, maybe, then to move up to the school spelling bee and then to the district spelling bee and then on up like that, right? Until you can have your Aquila and the Bee moment in Washington, D.C. Unfortunately, fifth grade, I got a little fat and cocky in the spelling bee contest. My kids still laugh about this, and I still can't believe I did it. Well, you know, what did I misspell to go out early in the fifth grade spelling bee contest? You know, was it encyclopedia? Was it, hyperbole? What was it that I misspelled? No, it was the word truck. That's right, truck. We were all lined up. She said truck. I chuckled, said, ha, truck. T-R-U-C-H, truck. What? It's one of those moments I'd like to go back in my life. I've got plenty, by the way, and change. But alas, you know, you live and learn. So my question is, though, what is the most, I've been thinking about this, what is the most commonly misspelled word that you encounter? Maybe it's a word you still struggle to spell. Or maybe it drives you crazy when you see how other people spell it. There are some words out there. I don't care how good you are. There are some words that you're going to trip over. I came across a 25 most commonly misspelled words quiz online, and I think actually there ended up being 27 questions on it. I got 23 of the 27 right. There was one I misread, so I'll cut myself some slack there. But still, so they ask how to spell various words like this, like accommodate. If you don't use two C's and two M's, you're in trouble. The word acknowledgement. Another one. How about, let's see, deductible. Maybe not quite as hard. Embarrass. That gets people sometimes. Harass. Let's see. Indispensable. Judgment sometimes trips people up. Liaison. How about that one? So it's not as easy as you think. Of course, then you've got the whole there thing, right? The T-H-E-R-E, T-H-E-I-R, and T-H-E-Y apostrophe R-E. That's butchered oftentimes. So would be interested in what you think, what your thoughts are. 573-4BREAD-4 is the number that you can call or text. Or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Or you can post your response on Facebook or on Twitter. We've gotten a few people who have done that. Christy says, in fact, on Facebook, the word separate. And I'm assuming that she did this some sort of ironic thing, but she misspelled separate on her post. Yes, she did. Okay, she did this on purpose. And a lot, putting the two words together, A-L-O-T, when really it's separate, S-E-P-A-R-A-T-E, and a space lot. She said those are the first that came to mind, even though the second is two words. Misspelled words drive me crazy. And then there's mispronounced words. So the other night, I was at one of my daughter's senior events, and it was end of the year faculty thing. That's right. And I was talking to this lady, and I said, by the way, I don't think we've met on Mike Allen. She said, oh, yes, we've met. She said, we met out at Raven Run when you were out there hiking with your daughters, which is a nature sanctuary near Lexington. And yes, I remembered it. And then I remembered where I had met her. It is a situation my kids still have not let me live down. We were hiking. We came to this beautiful scenic overlook, and there was this lady. Now I'm blanking out on her name. She was one of my teacher's long-term subs. And it was wintertime, and we were out there, and I said, and I quote, boy, I love being out here in the winter. The view is so beautiful without all this foliage. Not foliage, but foliage. And my kids to this day don't let me forget that pronunciation faux pas. And of course, when I realized who the lady was, I said, oh, yeah, that's right. I remember now because I said foliage instead of foliage. And she didn't laugh and say, ah, I didn't even notice. She just kind of went, mm-hmm. So anyway, spelling, mispronunciation, good to keep you humble. Big news, of course, out of the NBA last night, Golden State backs against the wall, coming home down 3-1 to the Thunder and finding a way to get a win. Now, I will say it again, I did not watch the game. But watching the highlights of it this morning, it appears that it was a game in which Golden State really struggled to get significant separation. So they didn't win the game. They ended up winning by, 9 points, I think, in the game. But the fact that the Thunder, in a must-win game for the Warriors at home, hung around, I don't think bodes well for the Warriors returning to Oklahoma City. I could be wrong. Of course, now Oklahoma City is facing sort of its own must-win because you're up 3-1, and then you lose that game 5, and you come back home, your last game at home in the series. You don't want to be going back to Golden State for a game 7. So the pressure, I'm not saying it shifts off of Golden State, but the Thunder have some pressure of their own to deal with now, knowing that if you do not eliminate Golden State, then you're setting up a pretty tough Game 7 scenario. Other big news yesterday was the firing of Art Briles, the head coach of the Baylor University Bears. The Baylor football story, in terms of the rise of a perennial moribund program, has been pretty remarkable. And really, it's one of those situations where you give all the all the credit for their rise as a football power to Art Briles. I mean, Nick Saban, what he's done at Alabama, certainly incredible. But come on, it's Alabama. You could send me to Alabama, and I'll probably win at least 6 or 7 games. I mean, Art Briles went into a program that had not been to a bowl game in 13 years, and a team that had never had been a national contender, and it's exactly what he made him them into, is a national contender. He is now being swept away with the athletic sexual abuse and rape scandal going on there at Baylor, and in my opinion, rightly so. I mean, the buck has to stop with the head coach, and I think some of the administration, Ken Starr, the president, perhaps, getting off a little lighter than they should. But you know, a lot of people are commenting that this sort of marks a new era in college football, that winning is not everything. It may be a lot, and probably Art Briles survived longer than others would have because of his winning. But if that's the case, if this really does mark a new day and a new era in college football, that a program whose very national prominence is dependent completely on the head coach, and the head coach has actually brought about the building of a new stadium and a huge cash cow infusion into the program, to fire that coach because he did not hold players to account. He tried to protect players and their abusive behavior toward women. That hopefully is a sign of a new day in college football, and maybe a broader societal development in terms of how we treat abuse victims and how we deal with the inexcusable in our institutions, sports, religious, educational, whatever the case may be. So kudos to Baylor for making that call. You know, that doesn't mean that this has solved the problem at Baylor, because there's still, I'm sure, a culture there that has to be dealt with. But, of course, Baylor's situation, all the more important that they make this stand, given the fact that they are a Christian school, or purport to be. So we'll see. Will this be? It's hard for me to imagine Baylor football surviving to the level of degree of on-the-field success it's had after this. So they really are saying that, you know what, winning is important, but it is not everything. And I'm not giving them, you know, an A-plus for their motives. I'm sure there's public pressure as well. But nonetheless, Baylor made the decision, and I think it's the right one. 573-4BREAD-4, if you've got a comment on that, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Let's see if we can sneak in a What Were You Thinking here before the break. This from Channel 12 News in Arizona. Man rescued after hiking North Mountain with no water. But he did have beer. A hiker is doing okay Thursday morning after being rescued from North Mountain. Phoenix police say he took a bus to the popular trail to hunt for snakes. What? Around 1:30 a.m., more than 12 hours later, emergency crews say he called 911 asking for help getting down the mountain. It took four rescuers and a helicopter to save him. Police say the man didn't take any water, but he did tell them he took beer. I mean, there's water in beer, right? Emergency crews checked the man out and then took him home. Officers say they don't know if there'll be any charges. Oh, my goodness. You're going to go hike a mountain under pretty austere conditions and no water? Just beer. Anyway, all right, we'll give you the two other ones when we come back for the break. This is the Mike Allen Show. What was I thinking? Right at the bottom of the hour. We're right at the bottom of the hour here on the Mike Allen Show on this Friday, the 27th of May. Long weekend ahead. My question of the day, what is the most commonly misspelled word you see? Maybe it's you yourself who misspell it, or maybe it's somebody else and it just drives you crazy. Well, this is your chance to vent. 573-4BREAD-4, you can call or text, or 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. We need to get into our other What Were You Thinking nominees of the day. We've got a couple of others to mention here, spanning the globe and looking at examples of human beings not putting their best thinking foot forward. How about this story? Also out of Arizona. So you had the guy climbing the mountain who didn't take water, who only had beer. Now we've got an unlicensed dentist there, arrested. She'd evidently been driving up from Mexico and been performing unlicensed dentistry in an apartment. According to Arizona Attorney General Mark Brinovich, which was announced Wednesday, that Elda Graciela Marquez de Zamora, 54, was indicted by a grand jury after her arrest. An undercover special agent from the Attorney General's office reported they set up an appointment with Mama Elda. That's what she went by. Now, listen, I have no doubt that sometimes the licensing requirements to being a practicing dentist in the U.S. may prevent an otherwise qualified immigrant from practicing dentistry. In fact, I have a friend who was trained in Colombia as a dentist. Full dental school, all the rest, and here in the U.S., she has to be a dental hygienist. So sometimes those hurdles can be a little much, but my guess is there's something different going on. But if you're going to go to an unlicensed dentist, don't you want to go to somebody not called Mama Elda? Come on in to see Mama Elda. Bite on this stick while I do this root canal. Anyway, it's hard enough for me to go to a licensed dentist, if you know what I mean. So I'm not so much criticizing Mama Elda as all the people who went to her. But the winner of our What Were You Thinking Award is going to go to Major League Baseball Hall of Famer Wade Boggs. Wade Boggs, who, of course, played for many, 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 many years with the Boston Red Sox, really where he's cut his teeth, until he did the unthinkable and went to play for the New York Yankees. Now, Red Sox, Yankees, I don't care what they say down in on Tobacco Road, North Carolina Duke, or what they say down Alabama Auburn. Red Sox, Yankees is the classic sports rivalry. And so when Wade Boggs went back to Fenway Park to be honored along with other members of the 1986 American League champion Boston Red Sox. Now, if you remember, this is back before the Boston Red Sox had won a World Series since 1918. 1986, they got all the way to the World Series where they lost a bitter series to the Mets. Think Bill Buckner, ball between the legs. But they're still honoring the team. Wade Boggs shows up Fenway Park to honor his fellow teammates, and he's wearing his Yankees World Series ring. Way to endear yourself to Beantown there, Boggsy. So that's our winner. What? Really? Really? Anyway, 573-4BREAD-4 if you've got one you want to chime in with. 573-4BREAD-4. You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. I guess you could possibly ask a, you could make a What Were You Thinking point about Donald J. Trump. Donald J. Trump, who I believe it was yesterday, wrapped up all the delegates that he needs to be the official nominee, the official Republican nominee for president in 2016. And of course, there's been a lot commented on in the Trump candidacy and the upcoming Trump-Clinton race. But, you know, one of the interesting things is, you know, one of the ideas has been is the classic political campaign strategy is that you say extreme things in the primary season in order to energize the base of your party. But then when the general election mode kicks in, you shift to the center, try to pick up as many independents and moderates as possible. Well, Donald Trump, who has thrown conventional wisdom on its ear, appears to be following the same counterintuitive path when it comes to the general election. He was at a rally in New Mexico. There has been some speculation, for example, when people are thinking about running mates for the Donald, that he would pick someone like Governor Susana Martinez of New Mexico. She's the most prominent Hispanic woman in American politics. She, as a woman, of course, would counteract Hillary's drive to be the first woman president. The fact that she would be, she's a Hispanic, given Donald's very, very, very poor poll numbers among Hispanics. You would think that reaching out, building a relationship of some sort with Governor Susana Martinez of New Mexico would be a smart thing for Donald J. Trump. However, again, we're talking Donald J. Trump. He was at this campaign rally in Albuquerque in Mrs. Martinez's state, which she did not attend. She still has not yet endorsed him for president. And Mr. Trump unleashed a blistering assault on the governor, who skipped the event by saying she was, quote, not doing the job. He faulted her by falsely asserting she was allowing Syrian refugees to settle in the state and blamed her for Albuquerque's unemployment numbers, as well as the increase in the number of New Mexico residents on food stamps. It's your governor's fault, Mr. Trump told thousands of booing supporters. We have to get your governor and get going. She's got to do a better job, okay? Your governor has got to do a better job. Now, this has thrown some GOP folks in a bit of a tizzy, wondering, okay, if Donald Trump would throw Susana Martinez under the bus, somebody who is one of those rare figures who could broaden the constituency of the Republican Party and our appeal across to people who are not the classic profile of a Republican, then who else could come under Donald J. Trump's blistering assaults? He's not exactly showing signs of being conciliatory to the party as a whole. Part of the reason that there were those who didn't want him to be elected or to be the nominee in the first place. Now, I guess there's two ways to look at it. On the one hand, there is the Donald Trump is so egotistical, so full of himself, so drunk with power and influence, that he doesn't care who he throws under the bus, and this is going to be the style in which he governs. Alienating, not bridge building, partisan, autocratic, all the rest. Believe me, that's a narrative I'm sympathetic to, I will say. Then there is the other spin on the situation. And that is that Donald Trump truly is the outsider that we thought he was. And all this does is, again, show everybody that Donald Trump is not beholden to anybody. He's not beholden to the old Republican guard, and he's going to be his own man. And if you're a Trump supporter already, then that's the sort of thing, that's the sort of narrative you latch on to that fuels your support for the Donald. So it is going to be a very interesting race, a very interesting convention, for sure. And by the way, Paul Ryan still not endorsing the now certain Republican candidate for president in 2016. Of course, things are not a whole lot better for Hillary Clinton. This email scandal continues to show signs of getting more and more significant. Could you actually have a Democratic nominee for president running for president while under, some enormous scandalous cloud? That's why I asked Tim Stanley the other day from Great Britain if Brits are kind of scratching their heads saying, this country of 300 million people, these are your choices. Anyway, let's look back in history a little bit. What are some other things that have happened on this day throughout the ages, May 27th, over the years?
Where are we, dude?
These are the circuits of history, gentlemen. They'll take us to any point in time we wish.
Where are we?
Gentlemen, we're history.
On this day in 1907, the bubonic plague broke out in San Francisco, California. There were actually a couple instances of the plague in San Francisco only about 100 years ago. That's a little scary, isn't it? Born on this day in 1907, of course she's deceased now, Rachel Carson, the American biologist whose book helped inspire the environmental movement, was born, including the elimination of DDT from agricultural crops. You know, I wonder if our family, we have some immunological issues in our family, my sister's families and me. some of my cousins, I can't help but wonder if my grandfather, who probably used a heavy dose of DDT on his crops back in the day, perhaps some fallout in our family life, I don't know. In 1936, on this day, was born Louis Gossett Jr., of course, won an Academy Award Best Supporting Actor for his role as the drill sergeant in An Officer and a Gentleman. 80 years old today. On this day in 1968, Major League Baseball's National League awards Montreal the first franchise in Canada and the first franchise outside the United States, the Montreal Expos. Old Jerry Park, Rusty Staub, the early days of the Expos. Now, of course, they're the Washington Nationals. And the San Diego Padres became a team in 68 as well. Speaking of baseball, happy birthday to Jeff Bagwell and Frank Thomas, two great hitters back in the day. They're each 48 years old. Not quite as much staying power as Bartolo Colon, I guess, who's still going strong. We'll be back. This is the Mike Allen Show.
Well, you know I'm not much good at writing letters, so I gave up and decided that I'd call. No, there's really not much news to tell you. Things back here, they never change at all. It snowed today, it's cold here for November, but I hear the weather's warm out there. Oh, and if you see Bert Reynolds, would you shake his hand for me?
15 minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show.
So that's all the other on this date sort of things. It's Don Williams' birthday today. If you're not familiar with Don Williams, that's something we shall have to remedy, isn't it? Don Williams, one of the great voices in country music, in my opinion. The Gentle Giant, he is 77 years old today. Recently gave up touring. I was disappointed. He was going to be here about 2 hours east of here in the town of Prestonsburg, Kentucky, at the Mountain Arts Center. I was hoping to go see him, and then he had to have hip replacement surgery and cut his farewell tour short. But Don Williams, that's one of my favorite Don Williams songs, by the way. If Hollywood don't need you, honey, I still do. 573-4BREAD-4, if you want to chime in on our question of the day. I put a link to some highlights from the Scripps Spelling Bee. Which I find the whole spelling bee thing pretty fascinating. And if you ever want to watch a good movie about it, see Aquila and the Bee, made a number of years ago with Lawrence Fishburne in it. And I forget the young girl who played Aquila. Very, very good movie. But yet it gives you some of the background dynamics of that whole process of spelling bees. But we don't have to go to spelling bees to find misspelled words. We see them all the time. My question is, what's the most common misspelled word you encounter? And we'll get extra points for you if you share one that just drives you crazy that you see. 573-4BREAD-4. If you want to chime in, call or text, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post your comment on Facebook or on Twitter. Very disturbing news from the Crux Now website. More anti-Christian violence in the Middle East continuing. Muslim mob attacks Christian homes in Egypt. This from Cairo. A mob stripped an elderly Christian woman and paraded her naked on the streets in an attack last week in which 7 Christian homes were also ransacked and torched in a province south of the Egyptian capital. According to the local Orthodox Coptic Church and security officials, this reported by Hamza Hindawi of the Associated Press. The assault in the Minya province village of Karama on Friday began after rumors spread that the elderly woman's son had an affair with a Muslim woman, a taboo in conservative Egypt. Police have arrested 6 men suspected of taking part in the violence and are looking for 12 more. According to a local television network, the 70-year-old woman was dragged out of her home by the mob who beat her and insulted her before they stripped her off her clothes and forced her to walk through the streets as they chanted Allahu Akbar, or God is great. The woman reported the incident to the police 5 days later, said Makarios, adding that she had found it difficult to swallow the humiliation she suffered. And this is just, you know, another chapter in the ongoing saga that we've seen of increasing violence against Christians as part of the so-called Arab Spring, which has been more like a deep, dark winter for the Christians in those regions. Yet in the midst of all that, perhaps a little bit of hope. This from Huffington Post, actually, HuffPost Religion. Why Catholics and Muslims alike come to pray at this shrine to Mary. As this from the country of Lebanon. During the month of May, it says, this by the associate religion editor of the Huffington Post, Antonia Bloomberg. During the month of May, Catholics around the world honor the Virgin Mary in a practice dating back to the 13th century. But at one shrine to Mary in Harissa, Lebanon, it isn't just Catholics coming to pray. The Shrine of Our Lady of Lebanon has drawn Muslim visitors since it opened in 1908, said the shrine's rector. Father Yunin obeyed in a recent video. They come as tourists, but also to pray and participate in Christian ceremonies at the site. Obeid said, all of the Muslim visitors have this big respect for Mary, a respect that stems directly from the Quran, the Holy Book of Islam, which references Mary 37 times, even more than the Bible does. The 19th chapter of the Quran is in fact named after Mary and tells the story of her life and how she came to give birth to Jesus. And although Islam does not hold the belief of Jesus' divinity, it does hold the belief in her virginal conception of Jesus. Mary has become, according to this story, a symbol of unity in Lebanon, as the BBC puts it, where war, interreligious strife, and the ever-present threat of extremism might otherwise tear people apart. The shared reverence for Mary is especially ingrained in the culture of Lebanon, where Christians, Muslims, and people of other faiths celebrate the Feast of the Annunciation on March 25th and visit the shrine during Mary's month of May and throughout the years. Rhonda Youssef, a Shiite Muslim woman from Beirut, told Catholic News Service she liked to come to the shrine to ask for forgiveness. I hope she listens to us to give our prayers to God, Youssef said. You know, Lebanon in and of itself is rather exceptional in terms of the interrelatedness of Catholics and Muslims, really, and Jews in many ways, except when perhaps, more extremist groups like Hamas come in to sort of try to gin up controversy. But for the most part, Lebanon has been a place where there has been great, relationships and mutual respect and tolerance. And now we see a sign here that Mary perhaps could be a great bridge building reality among Christians and Muslims. By the way, this is not a surprise. This has been understood for some time. In fact, I've got a great book, and if you ever want to pick up an excellent book by the late Archbishop Fulton Sheen, it's called The World's First Love, and it's about Mary, the Mother of God. It's beautiful. Of course, Archbishop Sheen, not only eloquent as a speaker, of course, but his writing is just fantastic. I still use a little book of his for my high school sacraments class. It's available online. These Are the Sacraments. So well done. But he has a whole chapter in The World's First Love on this question of Mary and what he calls the Muslims. Of course, we now say Muslim. But as he says here, this is in the words of the late Archbishop Fulton Sheen. Mary is for the Muslims the true Sayyida, or Lady. The only possible serious rival to her in the creed would be Fatima, the daughter of Muhammad himself. And how interesting, of course, that the Blessed Mother had her apparitions almost 100 years ago at Fatima, the Portuguese city named after the daughter of Muhammad, probably hearkening back to the original Muslim invasion and occupation of the Iberian Peninsula. But I digress. Anyway, but after the death of Fatima, Muhammad wrote, this according to Fulton Sheen, "Thou shalt be the most blessed of all the women in paradise after Mary." In a variant of the text, Fatima is made to say, "I surpass all the women except Mary." Fulton Sheen says, "Moslemism, or what we call Islam, is the only great post-Christian religion of the world. Because it had its origins in the 7th century under Muhammad, it was possible to unite it with some elements of Christianity and of Judaism, along with particular customs of Arabia. Moslemism, or Islam, takes the doctrine of the unity of God, His majesty and His creative power, and uses it, in part, as a basis for the repudiation of Christ, the Son of God. Misunderstanding the notion of the Trinity, Muhammad made Christ a prophet, announcing Him just as to Christians, Isaiah and John the Baptist are prophets announcing Christ." He goes on to talk about the claim that Islam is a heresy, which Hilar Belloc, the early 20th century writer, believed it to be. He said, "If it is a heresy, it is the only heresy that has never declined. Others have had moments of vigor, then gone into doctrinal decay at the death of the leader, and finally evaporated in a vague social movement. Islam, on the contrary, has only had its first phase. There was never a time in which it declined, either in numbers or in the devotion of its followers." He said the missionary effort of the church toward this group has been, at least on the surface, a failure, for the Muslims are so far almost unconvertible. By the way, though, just a little note, there's been a remarkable rise in Muslim conversions to Christianity here over the last couple of years. It's pretty remarkable. Google it up sometime. There's some amazing things happening, including some visions that some Muslims are having that are drawing them to Christ. But Fulton Sheen goes on basically to make the point that if there's going to be a bridge built between Christianity and Islam, it's probably going to happen through the Blessed Virgin Mary, who is held with such reverence and esteem among Muslims. And just as, you can think about, just as Mary was the great influencer at the wedding at Cana, and her intercession has such power, so can her intercession in this, what seems like a never-ending, bloody relationship in the way that Islam views Christianity. Perhaps it could turn, Mary, conceived without sin, pray for us who have recourse to thee. We'll be back with a new hour, including Chelsea Zimmerman. This is The Mike Allen Show.